Dreads, Tulupa, Naropa, Marpa, Mila, Lord of Dharma, Kampopa, Knower of the Three Times, Omniscient Karmapa, Holder of the Four Great Innate Lesser Lineages, Drikon, Takon, Salpa, Pistri, Gurya, Strupa, and so on, Masters of the Profound Path of Maha Mudra, Unequal Protectors of Beings, the Dakpung Kaju, Gavir Lamas, I supplicate you. Grant your blessings that I follow your example and hold your lineage. Detachment is the foot of meditation as is taught. To this meditator who is not attached to food and wealth, who cut the ties to this life, grant your blessings that I know attachment to honor and gain. Devotion is ahead of meditation as is taught. The Lama opens the gate to the treasury of oral instructions. To the meditator who always supplicates you, grant your blessings that genuine devotion is born within. Non-distraction is the body of meditation as is taught. Whatever arises is fresh in the nature of realization. To this meditator who rests simply in naturalness, grant your blessings that meditation is free from conceptualization. The nature of thought is Dharmakaya as is taught. Nothing whatsoever, it arises as everything. To the meditator for whom all arises in an unceasing play, grant your blessings that I realize samsara in nirvana undivided. Through all my births may I not be separated from the perfect Lama, and always enjoy the splendor of Dharma. Perfecting the qualities of the path and stages, may I swiftly attain the state of Ashwadhara.
Until I reach enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the stream and Sangha. Through the merit of accomplishing the six perfections, may I achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Until I reach enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the Supreme Sangha. Through the merit of accomplishing the six perfections, may I achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Until I reach enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the Supreme Sangha. Through the merit of accomplishing the six perfections, may I achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings.
May all sentient beings enjoy happiness in the root of happiness.
May they be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May they not be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering. May they dwell in the great equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and prejudice.
The earth is perfumed with scented water and strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun, and the moon. Imagining this as a Buddha field, I offer it so that all beings may enjoy that pure realm.
In accordance with the capabilities and diverse aspirations of sentient beings, I ask you to turn the wheel of Dharma,
of the greater, lesser,
or conventional vehicles. So good evening to everyone. I'm very happy to be here. I've been looking forward to it. I guess there's many reasons. I guess one reason is I know it's a small group of serious practitioners, but also practitioners who are students of a very special teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche. I was just telling Gina today that he's actually my teacher also. For many years, maybe 25 years, I've taken teachings from Trungpa Rinpoche, and I was just recalling today that the first time I ever
took Bodhisattva vows was from Trungpa Rinpoche in Nepal. So I feel very deeply honored to serve any of his sangha and activities. So I'm very happy to be here for those reasons. Aside from the fact that now I have friends here, and I enjoy that very much, and I've had great experience with both the sangha down east and also here in Portland. So I'm very happy. So I was thinking a lot about how I could serve here or contribute, and the thing that came to mind immediately had to do with practice. And the importance of being clear on practice and understanding what practice really is, which is really just an ongoing inquiry for all of us, I think. I can say that that's how I experience it. It's an ongoing open question. And I feel that we do many practices, and there's many ways to talk about these particular practices, but there are certain things about all of these practices that are the same. There's like a common thread that runs through the different practices, and I thought it's most useful to talk about these things. You know, we could talk about the technicalities of a certain practice, but why we practice and what's the meaning of practice and what does it mean to have like a liberation or what does it actually mean to practice? This is an important question, I feel, that is important to look into. And I do it all the time just on my own. And I notice that in my contemplation, which comes out in the way I teach or the way I speak about the Dharma, recently I've been using some interesting words to describe what I feel my practice is. It changes all the time. This just happens to be the current way that I'm experiencing my practice. And I think we have to find our own language for our practice. You know, they talk about in Buddhism the three wisdoms. There's the hearing, where we receive the teaching. So in other words, someone is explaining the Dharma to us, whether it's a teacher or we're reading a text or what have you. Then there's contemplation. This has to do with how we actually explain the Dharma to ourselves. So I'm kind of coming from that place. And then there's, of course, the meditation, which is the direct experience of all of it. So I've noticed recently that I've been talking about practice and experience, kind of the freedom that comes from practice, is like a falling apart. I'm using the word falling apart a lot, and a letting go into humbleness is another thing that speaks to me personally. Letting go into humbleness, falling away, falling apart. So again, you know, it's important for us all. This is my language. And I hope it communicates something as I talk about it tonight. But again, it changes, and we all have to find our own language to make this very personal. And language is very, very, very powerful in this way. So I give these, some of you might know, I give these links. They're called the personal links over the web stream. People listen to it over the they stream it. And I do it once a month. My teacher, Kongtrum, she also does one a month, and my son, and then a Sangha member from our Sangha. So I was giving a talk 2 months ago, and I used this term falling apart. And the students come online and they ask me questions. And there's this one student named Therese, who's a very creative person, and asked me an excellent question that I didn't have a chance to answer on the phone right away. I had to think about it a little bit, and it would have taken too much time. So tonight I'm going to answer her question for you, and it was very helpful for me. I feel like these questions that people ask, sometimes they send them to me on my blog or just in the context of a teaching, they're like gems. Each and every one of them open a door to something for me personally and then for everyone who's there and listening. And so I'm going to open this one up and share this one with you. So I have it here. Here's the question. She emailed it to me afterwards, and I have pretty much verbatim what she asked, and it's an excellent question, I think, that will help clarify practice for all of us. She said, "Discipline seems critical on the path. It provides the fuel of awareness to let our preconceptions about the world and people in it fall apart. In order to let things fall apart, we need to relax and let go. What is the relationship between discipline and relaxation? They often seem to work against each other. So I'm going to try to speak to this tonight. When I use this term, fall apart, obviously it doesn't mean hysterically falling apart, like emotionally falling apart. We often use the term that way. To me, it means the falling apart of our ego. And I've been thinking lately, well, what actually is the ego? It's always ego, ego, ego in the Dharma. And sometimes I think we use the word so much that we just kind of assume we know what it means, but we don't look that carefully. And I always think, that, at least for myself, I'm seeing myself do that, using the word ego, but it's extremely abstract. It's extremely abstract. Maybe it's abstract because actually, if you really look for it, you can't find it. There's no like solid, singular, permanent entity. We could say, oh, there's the ego, you know, or self. So it's very elusive in that way. And so I was thinking more about, well, what is the ego exactly? And it came into my mind that actually the ego is made up of belief or beliefs, many beliefs that we have about ourselves, who we want to be, who we are in relation to other people, this feeling of me and thinking that this me exists. These are beliefs. And what are beliefs? Beliefs are thoughts that we experience, thoughts or experiences that we have decided are true. Whether we just have decided this consciously or not is a different thing. I think we have a lot of beliefs we're not even conscious about. The realness of things, you know. There's a sense that things are real and that they're static. But actually, when we look at any particular thing, it's changing and open to interpretation. So there's not really a speck of realness in anything. There's not any absolute definitive way we can describe any one thing in a relative sense. We all see things so differently. So beliefs are thoughts that we have, fleeting thoughts, but we decide that they're real, and we can hold on to them very tightly. And they're not really just conceptual. I mean, beliefs can be patterns of thoughts. You know, we can have certain thoughts that come again and again and continue to enforce some kind of belief. But they're not always conceptual. For example, this tendency, this belief in a self, it just manifests as constantly trying to cherish and protect ourselves. You know, that's a very strong activity based on beliefs. Beliefs express themselves not just conceptually, but emotionally, energetically, physically. You can look at people and you have a sense of some kind of belief patterns that they have, just the way we hold ourselves and walk through the world. There's a sense of people's beliefs. When I'm talking about the falling away of beliefs, I'm talking about the freedom from ego logic, the freedom from grasping to all these ideas, whether they be conscious or not conscious, which is a really wild and wonderful. Not just an idea, experience sometimes that we have. And I would say that this speaks to the liberation of the practice, the liberation that we feel from practicing. And it speaks of the purpose of the practice as well. You know, in the words that there's a text, a Dzogchen text, Tiksum Nedek, it's the three words that strike to the vital point. It says, what's the real point of practice? It's liberation, freedom. That's why we're doing this. You know, when I talk about the falling of beliefs or freedom or liberation, I'm not really talking about any kind of highfalutin experience, like enlightenment, you know, da-da, you know, with lights. I feel that freedom actually, in a certain way, can happen for someone who's not a practitioner, even. And I just want to tell you a very interesting story. This year, maybe in March, I met with a friend when I was traveling. And she came to talk to me. It's not someone I know very well, but we've become friends. And she wanted to ask me a question. And she came to me and she told me a little bit about her life. She was in a 30-year relationship with a man, her husband, who beat her incessantly and abused her terribly for 30 years. And she told me that she felt she let it continue because she felt worthless and she thought that she deserved it. This was her belief. This was her belief. So one day, for reasons unknown, she had a moment where she describes as seeing the beauty and truth of who she was. Seeing the beauty and truth of who she was. And this was 15 years into the relationship. And it was very impactful for her. And it took her 15 years still to get out of the relationship. But it was because of that experience that she had that she actually ultimately was able to slowly extricate herself from that situation. I found that very fascinating because in order to stay in that kind of a situation, you have to have very, very strong beliefs that you're quite entrenched in. Again, emotional, physical, conceptual, and energetic. All of those levels of beliefs, you would have to have those in order to stay in such an abusive and uncomfortable situation. So she had very strong beliefs meshed, as you might imagine, in these beliefs. So her question for me was an interesting one. She said, well, what's the truth? Is it the truth that I was worthless and deserved it? Or is it true that I'm beautiful, you know, there's a beauty and truth to who I am? How do I know what's true? And I found that a very poignant question, and actually I couldn't answer it right away. I had to really think about this one, how I would respond to such a thing. And so I told her, well, I'll email you in a few days. Let me think about it. And I did. I really thought about it quite a lot because it's her question, but it's also, what is the truth? You know, what do we believe? How do we know? You know? And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, you know, to have that belief that you shut down around and you're so entrapped by, you know, thinking you're worthless and you deserve to be beaten is a very strong belief. But what it sounded like to me is that her beliefs fell away. For a moment. She had a moment where her beliefs fell away and she didn't objectify herself. I am like this. There was just this openness, this bigness to who she was. So that's what I told her I felt had happened. And I guess if you want to say there's a truth, you can say that the truth is this place where there's not these limited beliefs. There's this openness, you know, kind of like when we look up at the stars at night. You know, you feel so humbled by the largeness. You feel very small in relationship to the sky, and you feel very humbled by it. And yet you also feel very much a part of it, and that's very beautiful. So it's something like that. I feel that the way she described her experience, and I think, do you know what I'm talking about? I feel when I talk about this, people seem to know what I'm talking about, which is very heartening. And wonderful, because this is a good reference point for us. You know, often our reference points we see as our confusions, but we should have a reference point that's not confused. And that's, I think, what I was trying to say to her is, and it became her reference point, you see, because this is how she got out of a 30-year abusive relationship. She kept coming back to that moment. That moment had so much power for her. So it was. I felt so appreciative, and I asked her, "Can I share your story? You know, I won't use your name or anything." She said, "The more you use the story, the more healing I will feel from this experience." So she's very generous with her experience, and I feel she's in a wonderful place with all of it, and very compassionate toward her ex-husband and so forth. Because so much intelligence arose for her from that experience. It's not like just a falling away of beliefs and just getting confused and vague, but actually there's a sense of clarity and precision and knowing how to make something happen that's supportive of awakening, you know? It's a very beautiful story, I felt. And so her awakening, so to speak, or her liberation, wasn't like stepping in, going from one state to another state, like walking into one room to another room, but it was more like all the walls fell away. Do you know what I mean? That's what it felt like to me, this experience. So I was highly appreciative of this. So it's interesting, because of the beliefs we have, we often protect ourselves from the fullness of our own life. We protect ourselves from the fullness of our own life. My teacher, Khongtrum Shi, recently was saying that that's actually aggression to our experience. And I wanted to share something, if I could share any kind of like practice advice that I got from my teacher, or share something that has been most helpful for me personally, that I've received from my teacher, is this. Once I was struggling a lot in a retreat. I went through my periods of challenge, you know, with my retreat, and I told Rinpoche that I was having a hard time. And he said to reject, there was a rejection of experience. I didn't want to experience what was happening, or else I wouldn't have a problem with it. If you're completely open and willing to have whatever is arising as an experience, then of course we don't reject it. But he said that to reject experience is aggressive to the natural vitality of the mind, you know, that kind of open quality that we're talking about. That when we close down around our belief system and our ideas about our experiences, we're being aggressive. And he said that Buddhism is about nonviolence. It's not about aggression. I feel this is, for me, has been very important, because when things arise, and I can appreciate them or value them in a certain way. And when you're aggressive with your experience, life can't really touch you. You're always pushing it away. And I don't think that's what practice is about. I think life is to touch us. Life is to touch us. So, you know, I'll talk about that more. As I go on. But it's interesting, because sometimes I do hear practitioners say they haven't seen much progress or change on their path. You know, we all go through periods where we feel, why isn't anything happening? Or I don't feel a difference. And someone told me recently, a friend of mine, he said, you know, sometimes with my practice, I actually feel like I'm keeping my life at bay a little bit. Keeping my life at bay. It's like you're not really even experiencing your life fully. And I thought this was a very astute and subtle observation. And I know I felt that. So I could understand. And I think most people feel that sometimes. It's like, wow, by the end of the day, what happened? You know, and life is just going by, and I'm not kind of connected to my own life in a certain kind of way. So there's this feeling of being kind of detached from life. And when we feel detached from life, there's something happening where we're not letting life in. We're not being touched by life in a certain kind of way. And I notice that sometimes, I've noticed that in myself, you feel that in your physical body, like you feel blocked or something. You sit down to practice and you can really notice it. Like there's a hardness. There's not a porousness about our physical being, our emotional being, our energetic being, and our conceptual being. There's a hardness there. And sometimes the breath gets very shallow, like we realize, wow, I'm not even really breathing. It's blocked, you know. It's very important just to witness that, you know, and see how that is sometimes. Very fascinating. So I think that's what my friend was talking about. So this is important to look at. And I wanted to share another interesting story, a story that's very fresh for me that just happened a few weeks ago. I'm very excited, actually, to talk about this. This was a very, very helpful experience for me. I think it could be helpful for you. I was invited to a conference in Garrison, New York, upstate. And it was, I think, 230 Buddhists of different traditions, all the traditions that there are had representatives, to come together and have like an interfaith Buddhist dialogue. And sometimes it was a little bit dry and boring, especially the first day. I thought, oh, how am I going to get through this? But then the second day in the morning, have you heard of the Dharma Punks? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's this group of young men, maybe in their 30s now, I guess, and they were people who were really involved in some nasty business when they were younger. They've all been in prison. They're covered in tattoos. They're shaven heads. You could look online. They're really interesting people. But now they have Buddha tattoos all over instead of, you know, other tattoos. They're dudes, you know, and they're quite rough looking, and they've all been in prison and addicted to drugs, and they've gone through a lot. And you can see they're youngish, but they look really like they've been roughed up a bit by life, and they've been rough themselves, and you can feel it. But they came to the Dharma, and they love it. Love it. And some of them are teaching. So they were at this conference, three of them. And one of them's named Vinny Ferraro. Perfect. And he, very rough-looking guy, but with this beautiful spark to him. Anyways, he led this practice in the morning. So some of these, the people who were there, they're, you know, well-known teachers well-known and, you know, kind of famous and older, some of them. But there's this group of next-gen practitioners. I just missed it by like a year or 2 years. I was so bummed because I was taken with them, and we had a kind of nice exchanges between ourselves. But anyways, so these guys were the next gen people, and they were going to lead us through a practice, which I was kind of interested because it was a little bit dry there for that first day. So Vinny was the head of the whole thing, and he's standing up on the stage with a mic. And what he did is, it was a big cathedral, this incredible cathedral, kind of a big rectangular room. And he took a piece of tape, and he put the tape across the room. So it divided it into two sections lengthwise. And he said, okay, everybody stand on one side of the line, one side of the tape. So we all stood on one side. And then he said, everything in here needs to be confidential in terms of what happens. Like, I could talk about this, but this is a very personal practice, and people need to be protected in this practice. So obviously I won't talk about the details, but it doesn't matter. The details mean nothing. So what he did is he started to ask people to cross the line. And what he did is he said, first of all, he was dividing people by categories. So he would say, first he started with ethnicity. So he said, whoever is, you know, Hispanic, cross over the line. So not that many people were, but they crossed over. And so the rest of us were facing these people. So he was dividing us in different ways. And then we would just look at those people and kind of feel their struggle and their beauty or whatever, and just look straight at them. And then he'd say, okay, you guys come back. And then he said, may all the African-American people cross over the line. And there were some African-American people, and just looking at them and kind of feeling who they are, how they've been separated out. It was quite juicy right from the beginning. It was painful and also wonderful, because there's wonderful things we know about the culture, but we know that there's been painful things. Then he asked, like, everyone who's Jewish cross over the line. And so then, again, that happened, and people would make, they have this gesture which means, like, we're with you, you know. It's kind of the tough guys kind of like, we love you kind of thing. Or some people are going like this, but there's a lot of care at that point. Then he'd say, you know, may any Native American people cross. So it went on for a while. So he kept dividing and dividing and dividing and feeling the pain of the division and so forth. Then it got a little personal. First he said, you know, please all the gay and transgender people cross over the line. And that happened, you know, and then again, there was this warmth and this kind of support, wanting to support. Then he said, may all women who have been abused cross over the line. You know, it's painful to cross over the line, actually. Whenever I had to cross over the line, there was some pain in it. Some pain in it. Then may everyone who grew up without parents in foster homes or just with a single parent cross over the line. And of course you feel the painfulness of watching other people cross over the line very deeply. Then he asked, who's ever been witnessed violence or had violence, been a victim of violent violence cross over the line, or has may let everybody who has been in combat cross over the line. So that happened. Then it moved into the realm of Dharma. Oh, this got really interesting. He said, I get the chills just thinking of it. It was very powerful. If you've ever abused your power as a Dharma teacher, cross over the line. If you felt that you've ever judged another tradition, you know, cross over the line. If you've been inappropriately approached by a teacher, cross over the line. And people cross over. It just got increasingly personal, and people were so courageous to cross over the line. It's like nobody was being judged, because we all know that it was painful to cross over this line. And when we had to cross over, we felt the pain of it too. It was very, very extraordinary. And what I felt is, yeah, to cross the line is really to look at your own pain and to be very honest and to let that, and to not harden around that, and to let people witness that, you know. People were looking at who was crossing the line, you know. And some of these people were known, you know. I mean, so it was really courageous. And you find yourself crossing again and again and again, you know. And it was incredible because it united 230 people of different traditions, you know. I thought to myself, what was it that was so powerful and moving to me about this? And this is just my take on it. But what I felt it did for me is it moved it from a place of I am suffering, my own story, to there is suffering. There is suffering. Everybody is crossing back and forth over this line, you know. So that suffering became not so personal. And another thing I noticed is that I realize that every reason I crossed over the line, everything that has happened to me in my life, makes you see how full your life is, actually, too. All the reasons I crossed over, everything that's happened to me has been of value to me and my practice. This is something that I could see. So it was quite difficult to cross the line, because it really demands that you look and not turn away, and to let the life touch you rather than hold your beliefs. Do you know what I mean? But there was like this danger in it too, because you could get lost in your story. You could get totally lost in your own story, how life has been hard for you, you know, what you've gone through and so forth. And that was the most profound part for me, because I think that practice has something to do with being able to cross the line and not get lost in your story. So, you know, you kind of have to ask yourself as a practitioner, you know, am I in love with my story, or am I in love with the Dharma? You know, mm-hmm. That's a powerful question. And I've been asking myself that question a lot, because I see myself getting lost in my story sometime, and I have to come back, you know. So, again, we are always coming to the middle way, you know. It's not pushing, rejecting, and it's not getting lost in believing. It's something else entirely, you know. And that's where my friend had found that place, when she had that moment, and she trusted that moment. You know, in this way, the purpose of practice is really to really change us and transform us. That's really what we're doing this for, you know. Not these two ordinary ways of rejecting and getting lost in our story. And this requires a falling apart. This requires a falling apart of beliefs. If you don't look, you won't fall apart. And if you don't fall apart, there will be no liberation, you know. So, you know, I've been thinking lately that, yes, all practice is about falling apart. You know, that's why I've been feeling that. Describing my experience like that, it feels like that, and it requires this willingness to bear witness to your experience. Bear witness. It doesn't mean you have to believe it. That's getting lost in the story. It just means you have to be willing to be touched by your life. You know, I think practitioners we have this tendency to get detached and not let it really touch us. Maybe we're afraid of getting lost in our story, you know? So I wanted to, Nagarjuna's main disciple, Aryadeva, he has this quote that I always love. He says, "The moment you begin to question that things are not as they seem, the delusion begins to fall away." You know? The delusion starts to fall away, fall apart. So I've been thinking a lot about this. And I've been thinking, you know, what is practice in the context of this? And I do want to acknowledge that there is a discipline to practice. This kind of like an endurance training, as my teacher says. Like Nundro, you could say, in a way, is an endurance training. But there's more to it than that. But there's an aspect of practice where you have to push through. And we all know there's nothing in life worth doing that doesn't require a pushing through and a discipline and a repetition and a craft, a skill around it. So I want to acknowledge that. We've all had to do it and probably still do it to some extent. But the technique is not the practice. You know, sitting in a lotus is not the practice. Breathing is not the practice. Actually, saying mantras or visualization is not necessarily the practice, because you know we can do that without practicing, right? We all know that you can do the thing and not be practicing at all. And that your mind will not change. And you'll just be robotically going along because maybe you feel like you should, or whatever your beliefs are about it. So you can do these things without practicing. So my point is they can support. They're supports for the practice. But what is really the practice? And I like to get down to the essence of things, because we can talk about practice together regardless of what practice we do. This is at the essence of, and there's no practice that doesn't require some level of falling apart. You know, from the Four Noble Truths, the beginning of the path, to Dzogchen or Mahamudra, it's all about falling apart of the ego. There's nothing that isn't. So I thought this would be a good way to talk about it today. And what I thought I would do is I would go through different levels of the path and talk about how it is about falling apart. It might be interesting in that way. So I'm going to talk about the Four Noble Truths, because I think that's where it starts, just at the very beginning of the path. Because when we start asking what is suffering and what is its cause, what is the ego or the self, we're already breaking apart some beliefs. And when I think of the Four Noble Truths, one story comes to mind. It's the best story to kind of encapsulate the Four Noble Truths. And it's a very traditional story that you've probably all heard, but it's this story of the Gotami in the sutras. So I'll just repeat it, because it's a very powerful story, and it speaks to this. So Gotami was this woman who came to the Buddha holding the corpse of her child in her arms. And she was really distraught and crying and begging the Buddha, "Please bring back the life of my child. Please bring him back." And so the Buddha listened to her and he said, "Okay, I'll do it. But you have to do one thing first." So he said, "You have to go to every house in the village and collect a mustard seed from any home that hasn't seen or heard or known anyone who has died." So she did that. She went to every single house in her village. And of course she came back empty-handed, because everyone has known someone who had died. So the process for her was very healing, because she had to kind of bear witness to there is suffering and move out of "I am suffering" to have that experience. And she had to let the life touch her. She had to let the fact that there is suffering touch her. And when it did, she was able to put down the baby. And I love that story because it's about suffering and the cause of suffering, which is grasping and resisting experience. And it's about the path and cessation as well, and how she was liberated. You could say that was a liberation, that you could put your child down because you were able to accept that life is suffering, is a huge liberation. And something we have to face all the time, you know. So life changed Gotami, and in a way I feel that's a story about nonviolence, because she wasn't resisting something that was actually happening. It was very important, and it's very important to all of us not to resist impermanence and the fact that things are going to leave us and change and so forth, this is nonviolence, as my teacher calls that, nonviolence. To bear witness, let life touch us, let the delusion fall away, then have the liberation. This starts at the Four Noble Truths, I guess is the point I'm trying to make. So then, from the Four Noble Truths, we move into the Mahayana, where the skillful means are even stronger when it comes to falling apart. If you take a practice like Tonglen, for instance, rather than resisting experience, we're inviting everything we fear, everything that repulses us, all the suffering that we habitually aggressively reject. So it's really a very powerful practice of nonviolence. I think sometimes, we obviously do Tonglen for others, and that's important, and that we use others in this way. We want to benefit others, and we use our experience with others to do Tonglen. But it's not just for benefiting others. It's working against our ego logic, our ego logic of trying to cherish and protect ourselves. This hardness that doesn't want to fall apart. This always resisting aggressively our experience. So the discipline here is not to be aggressive to your own mind. When you're breathing in something that you want to push away, that's a practice of nonviolence, non-aggressiveness. We look, we let it touch us, and again, we let it, who we think we are and our beliefs fall apart. So this is another example of how the Mahayana practice of Tonglen, or any of the Mahayana practices really, is about the falling away of the self and the ego. If we look at Majjhimaka, for example, this is another method of falling apart, in that you're using your sixth consciousness, your conceptual mind, to disassemble, actively disassemble your delusion, your beliefs. So the Buddha said, there's the two categories of beliefs: there's the nihilistic beliefs and the eternalistic beliefs. And we think, oh, these are just philosophies, which sometimes they are. In the texts, often, where I'm sure Trungpa Rinpoche teaches us so incredibly well about the middle way and the Majjhimaka teachings from the texts. Nihilism, there's certain schools that believe that there's no order, there's no cause and effect, and there's certain schools that are theistic, and so they're eternalistic. But we also have these beliefs in who we are. When we feel depressed or meaningless, it's a nihilistic, and when we have a strong sense in self and other and we get angry and we see the world in that way, it's eternalistic, because we have this sense of realness, belief in the realness of things. So that's disassembling these kinds of beliefs, the falling away of views is very much what the Majjhimaka teachings and the Majjhimaka practice is about. And Nagarjuna said himself, he said, "I prostrate to he who has abandoned all views." He's talking about the Buddha. I prostrate to the Buddha because the Buddha abandoned beliefs and views. They fell away for him. That's his enlightenment. So Nagarjuna has that famous quote, one of my favorite quotes. It's very instructive and about what practice is. And I'll give you another kind of tradition. The Zen tradition, I feel, has a... if you've read my book, I like koans very much. So I want to just say one thing about the koan tradition, because this year I had... Baker Roshi is my neighbor. His wife and I ride horses together, and I'm quite fond of Baker Roshi, and he's been very kind to me, and he knows I like koans, so he invited me over, and we had tea, and we did some koan stuff together, and he taught me about koans. It was just the greatest afternoon ever. Koans are really about the demise of belief. Right or wrong, true, untrue, belief, doubt, existence and non-existence. They challenge, the koan challenges our dualistic mind to think one way or another, right, wrong, So beliefs are so limiting, because when we have a belief and we hold on to it and think it's true, then everything else has to be untrue. It's so exclusive. It's like a shutdown, in a way, in a certain kind of way. So a koan is challenges the dualistic mind. And the dualistic mind always wants to reach a conclusion, like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? That's really rough on the dualistic mind, because what do you do with that, you know? So it kind of throws you into kind of a frenzy in a certain kind of way, which is part of the beauty of it, you know? But it's always grasping for an answer, a right answer. So you're supposed to go off and contemplate your koan and ask it again and again, and then you go to the teacher and you think you're really clever and you have a right answer. And you're always sent away because you think you have a right answer. This is what I've heard. I haven't actually done it, the actual formal practice. And it could be that, like, five people go to see the teacher with the same answer, and sometimes he'll accept one and not another. And the basis on which a teacher accepts an answer has to do with whether they found a way out of the dualistic realm of ideas to that bigger place, like the place my friend found, beyond being caught, knowing that life is bigger than the ideas we have about it. That's maybe a way to describe it. This bigger quality of being is the whole point of a koan, is to arrive at that. So you're pushed, and you have to grapple with it, you know, until you get to that point. And what Baker Roshi told me, they call that experience, which I love, is it's called dying under the phrase. Dying under the koan. That's a falling apart. Just last week, I was in the Nyingma Summer Seminar that my teacher, Khong Trimche, does every summer. And we had a question and answer period. And this one of our students, Vanessa, asked him a very nice question about, a very practical question about, you know, she wants to think about the future of her family and save money. And so she's thinking of going into nursing and going back to school. And she has already a child, you know, an older child. But then sometimes she thinks about practice. And she wants to just let go and do that. And so, she, you know, it's the same. It's all of our koan, practically, right, in a certain way. And I hope I can do justice to Rinpoche's answer. Probably not totally. But what Rinpoche said was the fact that you have to juggle, that there's this kind of friction or tension or koan that can't truly be resolved in a certain way is what gives him buoyancy. And he talked about it like juggling. He's always juggling balls in the air. And that's what keeps him very alive and buoyant in his practice. So that it's not a matter of going here or a matter of going there. Kind of reminded me of like how planets rotate around the sun, and then there's this magnetic thing around them that's very powerful. That's what I felt in Rinpoche when he was saying this. So it's like his answer was not dualistic. It was something altogether different. It's not this way, go to nursing school, or this way, ignore your livelihood. It's all of it, you know, kind of juggling and seeing the beauty of that, you know, and seeing the power in that for himself. So I just wanted to share that because I thought it was fantastic. I could really feel it. It was like, for me, a little liberation. It liberated some conflict I had about that, or it took me out of my dualistic mind. All these things, these small things are liberations, you know. I guess I'm trying to get at that. So then we can go into Mahayoga practice. Mahayoga practice, you know, Cheren practice or what have you, sadhana practice. This is really about the falling away of seeing, you know, the skandhas and the elements and the emotions. It's about the falling apart of seeing them in a gross way. That's what that whole practice is about. I won't say so much about that. But we have strong ideas about our emotions, for example. They seem very real and solid. This is about the falling away of seeing them in that very limited way. And then there's the practice of having a teacher. I consider this a practice. Because it takes a lot from the part of, at least it has for me, I can say. Having a teacher has challenged me more than probably any other aspect of my practice. And my teachers are very provocative in that way. So, it's been a very powerful practice for me. But I feel with the teacher, it's all about letting go into humbleness. And actually, I have a friend who's studying Tibetan and Sanskrit at Oxford, and he translated mugu, devotion, as letting go into humbleness. It's kind of a literal translation. That translation is the best I've heard because it spoke to me. in my experience with my teacher. But Rinpoche's, my teacher has always told me that he's looking for students who, not in these exact words, but who are looking to fall apart, who have this longing to, for their ego to fall apart. And I really know what he's talking about, because I've seen in myself this longing to fall apart, and I see sometimes when I'm not willing to fall apart, and I see the difference in how I relate with him and he relates to me. And I look at the students and I can see who wants to fall apart and who doesn't want to fall apart. And of course it changes. It's not a static thing. And as I go out and teach, I think I see you can recognize this, how important this kind of longing to let go into humbleness is, as we talked about like in the beginning. You know, when you look at Tilo, he got Naro, and Naro was totally ready to fall apart. I always ask my teacher, you know, jumping off of cliffs and sticking these like bamboo splinters under his fingernails, and I was like, is that blind faith, you know, Rinpoche? I asked him. He says, no, they know exactly what they're doing. You know, it sounds a little, you know, outrageous for what, but I mean, but that's not the point. The point is they're just ready to give it all up. You know what I mean? The ego. That's really what that's about, you know. If you look at it as blind faith, it's not very inspiring. It's like, how would you relate to such a thing? I don't think I'd want to jump off a cliff. But maybe if I were, you know, I don't know. But it's hard for us to relate to those stories, because maybe when we're thinking of it in that way, we're not really understanding the true meaning of the spirit of the practitioner and the understanding of the teacher. So, you know, Tilo Naro, Naro Marpa, Marpa Milarepa, you know, building up all those towers. And he was so ready to have something happen. And so that's the way that it happened for him. And it's such a powerful, skillful means to have a teacher. So the discipline with the teacher really has to do with the willingness to fall apart. That's what it is. That there's a discipline definitely to being a student, I feel. And this is where it is. It's very important to know it. Otherwise, you're just waiting to be told or something. You know, this is important in the Dharma, is that, again, it's not how it's explained to us just. It's how we explain it to ourselves and make it personal to us, and know what we're doing. So that's the teacher. Then there's the practice of, say, like Nature of Mind or Mahamudra, which is... has to do with letting whatever is extraneous to the nature itself fall away. That's basically what that is, and that nakedness that they talk about. When all the beliefs, nihilistic and eternalistic beliefs about I am or I'm not, you know, fall away, this is when you experience the nature of mind. They talk about it being uncreated or ordinary mind or natural, you know, naked experience. They say, like writing on water. In the Dzogchen, they say, you know, like you write a letter and it dissolves as you write it. There's nothing to grab onto. There's the falling away of everything that's contrived or fabricated. So this, again, at the kind of pinnacle of the path is still about falling apart. So it starts with the Four Noble Truths and it carries on till the end of the practice cycle. I was thinking recently, too, about a dear friend of mine, Roy, a very dear Dharma brother who is my age, Japanese businessman, very handsome, black belt in karate, you know, very successful businessman who micromanaged everything. I was just telling Gina and Eric about him. And he contracted a very lung cancer about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. So the last month of his life, I stayed with him. Every day I came to be with him in the afternoon after his nap. And we talked a little bit about the Dharma, and he had many ideas of always thinking about the Sangha and what the Sangha should do, and it was beautiful, not thinking about himself at all. And then what we would do is we would practice dying together. We'd practice dying together, which I guess is the practice of letting go. So we'd sit together, and he'd be lying down, and we'd just pretend like this is it, and let go. How can we let go? How can we let go? So we did this for like 3 weeks together, maybe. And after 3 weeks, one day, and I could feel it happening to him, he really let go. And when after we were finished, he said, I died. It was very, very moving. And he was very different after that. The micromanaging stopped. We were happy about that. And he was so like himself, like a naked person. Because he's Japanese, we were formal together, even though we were very close. But all the formality fell away, and he was just like this raw, beautiful human being. You know what happens to people sometimes if they can let go. So that also reminds me, that's a liberation, to let go, you know. That's a liberation. So, you could look at any practice and see how it's about the falling apart or the falling away, the letting go process. And sometimes I think, this falling, the idea of falling apart gets a very bad rap. You know, even amongst Buddhists, because people use the words like, it's groundless, you know, I feel so groundless. And it's true. We often feel groundless, and it's scary. There's something about this that can seem scary to us. Impermanence, you know, emptiness sometimes feels scary. For everyone, and we have moments, or longer than moments, that we feel this way. But I was thinking about it a lot, because actually the times when we really are able to let things fall apart is when we have this open experience, like my friend had. So much intelligence, so much fearlessness, that ground and groundlessness is not even a question. You know, she just saw the beauty and truth of who she was. You know, this humbleness. But the fear and the pain actually comes from a holding on more than the letting go part. So, you know, it's important to make that distinction so we can understand that liberation is not a scary thing. Liberation is a open and fearless and courageous and intelligent, beautiful experience that we all have. It's not so remote. You know, I don't feel... that it's so remote. It doesn't seem like it. Gotami, you know, she had that liberation. It was a very painful situation when she was holding on to the child. It was very painful. But when she was able to put the child down after that experience, it was no longer, I'm sure, her heart was tender. You never forget the people or the beings that you lose in your life. But, it was a liberating experience, a freeing experience. So sometimes I do think people equate emptiness, impermanence, groundlessness, you know, with liberation. But I guess I'm trying to make a distinction that when there's pain, there's some ego grasping there. Somebody asked at Kong Trum Shade this week, how do you know when the practice has touched you? He said, when that dagger in your heart melts away. That's how you know you're having a liberation or a freedom. And I think we all know this. I think to some extent, sometimes we don't even acknowledge it, you know. Sometimes it's very small. Sometimes we're just self-centered, and then all of a sudden we're able to extend to someone else. There's a moment of compassion. That's a liberation, you know. Or... we're very resistant to our experience, and for some reason we feel all of a sudden humbled in some way, or some devotion arises, or some, you know, like doing a supplication, I don't understand, and kind of giving up and then moving into that realm of humbleness and supplication. That's a liberation. There's so many liberations that we can have, conceptual liberations, just conceptual. Like I was saying with the juggling thing, you move out of that dualism, you know, the conceptual dualism that you have. So these are all very freeing. And I think to know that this is our resting place as a practitioner, this is our resting place. We do have a resting place. It's not either you have ground or you don't have ground. It's something altogether different, that place without walls, you know, the place without walls. That's the resting place. So it's very important, I think, for us to kind of have that as a reference, like my friend had that as a reference. We need a reference. But it's not a reference like grabbing to reference. It's just altogether different, you know, altogether different. it's quite interesting. Like sometimes, you know, I've had personally, sometimes I have, we all have these tendencies to feel, I don't know, despair or something habitually, whoever we are, we probably experience it differently. Things that arise that are difficult for us that we have to work with, like habits and patterns, and sometimes it's depression or meaninglessness or takes some kind of form. So sometimes I've called it that thing that arises that I don't really understand, and it's very uncomfortable. And people usually know what I'm talking about because everyone has their own thing, how they experience it. And I was telling a friend recently, she was kind of struggling with something, that often, you know, during the day something will come and I feel a little irritated or disturbed, and so I think about my practice and I'm able to let go and fall apart or what have you. And that's wonderful. But sometimes when that thing arises, that hard thing, I try everything, all my usual, strategies, yeah. And it doesn't fall apart. And I try again and it doesn't fall apart. Then I remember, oh, the fact that I don't want it to be there is aggression. It's the aggression. So then I think, what if I... It's like I want to be somewhere else having a different experience. Basically, that's what it is. Once I remember that, I guess as you can say, this is a strategy too, but once I remember that that's what it is, then you can let go, because it's not a conditional happiness you're looking for. It's a valuing of anything that arises. That's where this becomes really powerful. This is where this is a vajra. That the vajra is indestructible. You know, this is where you're not dependent on causes and conditions. And I've had that experience a lot. We're getting really, really stuck. And then seeing that I'm being aggressive to the natural vitality of my mind. And I'll talk about this more tomorrow night, because I think this is valuing all experience is very important for our practice. And very much the spirit of a practitioner, you know. So, you know, when I went into my long retreat, I had already received this instructions from my teacher about nonviolence. This is really the single most important instruction I've had from my teacher. And I, you know, what can you say? I mean, it's in a way it's simple, but in a way it changed my whole life, what my teacher told me, I feel. You know, still I sometimes get stuck, but still then you know you can still value it. Like I was saying, you know, when I crossed over the line, I valued all those experiences. Therefore, they were precious to me. I wouldn't change back anything, you know. I already had this information when I went into retreat. So my intention was to practice based on this, practice this non-aggression. And I realized, I saw, you know, because you know how it is when you're in retreat and you can't really get away from your mind, it's too painful not to practice this way. If you have aggression toward your experience, it's horribly painful. So it's like a torture sometimes in retreat to reject. So I always, when I forgot, and I still forget sometimes, but then it comes to me after I've suffered enough. Look, let it touch you, you know, stay open, let it fall apart, you know. Let it fall apart. And don't get involved in the story. Don't get involved in your own story. Just let it touch you. And let it, it's a subtle thing. I'm talking, you know, if a person could really say what this is, then we'd all be in great shape, you know. So this is just my way of trying to explain something to you the best that I can, really. But what you experience then is this incredible courage and openness, and not so afraid of your mind. Less intimidated by your own mind. Which is like an amazing thing, because the mind is really intimidating and powerful, you know, especially when you're in retreat, you know, or even just doing a session of practice, it can be extremely intimidating. So I really feel, especially since I've come out of retreat, I felt very different coming out of retreat than I used to be before I went in retreat. I see that something changed, and I felt this willingness to let life touch me. That's what changed. The resistance to life wasn't there, and the interest in life and from learning from life was there more. That's how the retreat helped me a lot. You know, not saying, oh, now I'm fully, you know, anything. But I do see that I let life touch me more. This has made a huge difference for me. And I think, like, every day, at the end of the day, and I live kind of in a retreat situation. I live up in the mountains in a remote place, and sometimes I just see my cat, you know, that day. But by the end of each day, I feel very different, changed by my life. I don't know what happens, but I'm very kind of aware of my life, and I let it enter me or something, but not get lost in the story. That's the main thing. But I feel more willing to let that happen. So at the end of each day, I do feel changed, and I feel like that's the power of the practice in some way. That's the power of the practice. So, you know, just to get back to Teresa's question about the discipline, you know, it's true that there's this outer discipline, this endurance training, as Rinpoche says, this pushing through, and, you know, that has its own importance and character to it, and you need that to shape your mind and shape your attitude and get yourself present there, you know, and be there, you know, for your life, you know, some discipline. The breath, the posture, the recitation. I definitely don't want to say that that's not necessary, but the spirit of all that pushing has to do with the falling apart of beliefs. You know, sometimes it takes an axe, you know what I mean, to fall apart. For example, you know, Milarepa, you know, building up and tearing down. Sometimes you need to push to fall apart, you know. Sometimes you need to throw yourself down on the prostration board to fall apart. That's a real falling apart. That's like, sometimes I feel, I told somebody recently, this is what I felt when I did prostrations. I don't know. I don't know. You know, humbleness, humility, you know, it's just like, I don't know. Help. You know, like we were talking yesterday about supplication. You know, that's the spirit, you know, fall apart. This knowing, you know, I know the beliefs that we have. Prevent this from happening, you know. Get in the way of that spirit. Sometimes it takes a sixth consciousness, you know. Sometimes you have to grapple with a koan, you know. Sometimes it's easy to just let go and fall apart. So whatever you need to do to fall apart, you must do it. That's what I'm getting to. And that's one of the points. And the other point is, I don't think liberation is something to wait for. That's the main point. It begins with the Four Noble Truths. You know, I really say this with my deepest kind of heart. It's right now, you know. Enlightenment is a very abstract concept for us in a certain way. But with these small liberations, it becomes less abstract. It just becomes more consistent until it's effortless, you know, and then it's completely unobstructed experience. So I just want to say that this all begins at the Four Noble Truths. And if we have, and it can happen for us whenever we're willing to fall apart in that way. You know? So I'm sure that we can conjure up some juicy discussion. This is kind of a juicy topic. And I'd love to I always say, I just give a talk to get the dialogue going. And I say that really this is a Q&R, which means questions and responses, because I don't really believe there's any answers. It's more how we respond and bounce off each other and open things up together. It's not anything conclusive is ever going to happen from this, except just continuous openings in our practice. So I open it up, and we can talk about anything you feel helpful for your practice.